This episode is brought to you by Envision Studio, the world's most powerful screen design tool. Unlock new dimensions of screen design with Envision Studio's adaptive layout engine, rapid prototyping, advanced animation, shared design systems, and more. Visit userdefenders.com/studio to get early access.
What my last words are don't really matter. It's not really important. I mean, it would be nice to have something pithy to wrap it up with. Maybe it's, that's all, folks. I don't know. But maybe my last words are do a search through the archives on whatever interests you. Because basically, my website is all my last words, right? Like, when I'm no longer here, as hopefully the website could still be there and all of it accessible. It's something I wrote in 2011, something I wrote in 2002, something I wrote last week, still accessible, which again is, gets to the superpower of the web.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview UX superheroes who fight for the users in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to episode 47. I'm your host, Jason Ogle. Today, I had the great privilege of speaking to one of the web's pioneering greats. His handle is nearly as renowned as his surname, Adactio, aka Jeremy Keith. Jeremy has achieved and contributed immeasurable greatness to the web, yet he carries himself as just a normal gent who's trying to keep the web a great place to share ideas, knowledge, and humanity. Despite my shameless attempts at the end to convince him how great he is, I am certain none of it went to his humble head. It was also really refreshing to kick off this conversation with a total diversion from my normal questions and to an arena Jeremy is not really known for speaking to. I'll let you discover what that is. This was a really good one, Defenders, and ended up being more emotional than I anticipated. I'm not going to lie, it got a little dusty in the room for me at a certain point. That's probably more than enough of an intro to this unforgettable episode with the one and only Jeremy Keith. I want to share a recent iTunes review with you real quick. This one really tickled me as it beamed in all the way from Mumbai. This person is Karin Karnick, and I'm sorry if I mispronounce your name. This person says, favorite podcast on UX, 5 stars. Jason makes the conversation so very engaging. Been listening to this podcast for over a week now. The one with Laura Klein kept me smiling through a long traffic-ridden journey back home in Mumbai. I now look forward to driving every day so I get to learn from Jason and his guests. Thanks for being so cool and contributing so much to the UX world. Fight on, my friend. You have friends in India if you ever visit. Cheers. Wow, thank you so much, Karin, for making the time to leave that review. It really encouraged me, and it encourages me to know that I have friends like you in India, and I would love to take you up on that one day. Absolutely. It's just incredible, isn't it? The impact and the reach that the web and podcasting has. So thank you, Karin. And if you feel inclined to, as Karin did, leave an iTunes review, I would be most honored and will likely share it on a future episode. You can do so simply by visiting userdefenders.com/review. Thanks so much in advance. Jeremy Keith lives in Brighton, England, where he makes websites with the splendid design agency Clear Left. You may know him from such books as DOM Scripting, Bulletproof Ajax, HTML5 for Web Designers, and most recently, Resilient Web Design. He curated the Deconstruct Conference for a number of years, as well as Brighton SF, and he organized the world's first Science Hack Day. He also made the website HuffDuffer to allow people to make podcasts of found sounds. It's like Instapaper for audiophiles. Hailing from Erin's Green Shores, Jeremy maintains his link to Irish traditional music running the community site The Session. He also indulges in a darker side of his bouzouki playing. Jeremy, you'll have to tell me if I said that right. In the band
right.
Salter Cane. Okay, excellent. Jeremy spends most of his time goofing off on the internet, documenting his time wasted on Adactio.com, where he has been writing for over 15 years. A photograph he took appears in the film Iron Man. Welcome to User Defenders. I'm super excited to have you on the show today, Jeremy.
Oh, thanks, Jason. That's really nice. What a lovely introduction. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I'm very curious, and I'm sure our defenders listening are as well, about the photograph. Can you speak to that in Iron Man?
Sure. I mean, it's part of a... I'm not sure where to start with that. I mean, well, let's begin with you, actually, and... when we finally got to meet recently at Vendor Park Denver, and I was saying how much I really, really, really enjoyed the episode you did with your dad, where he talked about his life in rocketry, right?
Yes.
So it's so good. I mean, anybody listening, if you haven't listened to that episode, please go back and listen to it. It's really good. And I'm a space nerd anyway, so I really loved it. And I just loved the inside of it.
Thank you so much.
It's really good. But as I was saying, I've been down to the Cape and been shown around the place by another rocket scientist. And this happened quite a few years ago. It was 2006. I was in Florida for an event. It was in Orlando for a small sort of conference. Refresh, I think it was Refresh Orlando. It's only about 60 people there.
Uh-huh.
But I was there and my colleague Andy Budd was there. And some other Brits had been flown over, and Paul Boag, who does the Boag World podcast, he was there. And Paul said to us, listen, I got this email from this guy who says he works at NASA, and he's invited me to like come along to this open day where we can look around. And Paul was like, you know, would you guys want to come with me? Because I'm a bit nervous about meeting a stranger off the internet. And we're like, sure. You know, that sounds like fun. But we were thinking like, okay, one, you know, when he says he works at NASA, obviously he means, you know, he must be doing something on the website for NASA.
Uh-huh.
And this open day thing must be like something that happens every weekend and people pop along. But no, it turned out Benny was the guy. Benny was literally a rocket scientist. Like he worked on the engines on the back of the space shuttle and was like doing, you know, web and WordPress stuff on the side. And that's why he was listening to Paul's podcast. And that's why he'd been in touch. It was kind of nuts. You know, he was saying, yeah, I was thinking about getting into web design full time. And we're like, are you crazy? You're a rocket scientist. You should do the rocket stuff. And then this open day thing, which we thought was maybe something that happened all the time, it turned out this is the first time it was happening since September 11, 2001, right? There'd been pretty much a lockdown.
Mm.
And it's the first time that people were allowed into a lot of these places. And mostly it was, you know, family members of staff at NASA. So we were actually really, really lucky and privileged to be there. I remember when I got back, my wife was so jealous, you know, and I was telling her I'd been, oh yeah, I was right up close to the space shuttle and... It was really great. And one of the parts of getting shown around by a rocket scientist there was we got to go into the VAB, the Vehicle Assembly Building, which normally you wouldn't be able to go into, right? Amazing. I mean, right? It's such a huge structure. Yeah.
It's incredible.
So obviously the whole time I'm there, I'm snapping pictures, right? I'm taking pictures and they're fairly crappy pictures, you know. But there's one picture I take of my colleague Andy inside the VAB, and I'm trying to get like the scale of the inside of this building. It really doesn't come across in the photograph at all, and the photograph's kind of blurry and kind of rubbish. But anyway, I take pictures, I stick them up on Flickr. Now, I've been putting stuff on Flickr for years, and fairly early on, I decided to license all my stuff Creative Commons attribution, right? So anybody is free to use my pictures as long as they include a credit. And part of the reason I did that was just sheer laziness, because before that, I would get lots of requests for people, you know, can I use this picture for something? And I would always say, yeah, sure. But I have to, you know, the onus is on me to write that reply and say, yeah, sure. So I thought, you know what, by making the license like this, I don't have to reply to any of these emails anymore. People can just read the license and then they know they can do it.
Mm.
And so what was happening is people would still write to me saying, hey, is it okay? I'm going to use this, if I use this thing in this context. And I just wouldn't even bother replying because I'm like, look, I've changed the license. You know, occasionally I'd get around to replying, but generally I'd be like, you know, this isn't a priority because the license covers it.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So a few years after that trip to Florida, I remember an email pops up through Flickr saying, hey, I'd like to use some picture of yours. I didn't even look to see which picture in a movie that's being put together. And I was thinking, right, okay, so somebody's making like a home movie type thing, so some kind of student project, fine. And I'm like, I'm not going to reply. I got other priorities. I've set the license. If they can't read the license, you know, it's not a priority for me. Maybe I'll get around to it later. So I think I got a follow-up email. Said, oh yeah, I guess I should probably reply to that person.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was traveling, actually. I was in America for another event. So it was that Microsoft event that happened in Vegas. Mix, I think it was called. I've been invited over there by Microsoft. I think it was on the release of Internet Explorer 8. So that will probably date the event. And my phone rang, my mobile phone. And I thought, who's calling me on a phone? Like, nobody calls me on a phone.
Mm.
And it was this person who had emailed me. She tracked down my contact details. And she said, oh, yeah, I wrote to you through Flickr about using one of your photos. And I was like, oh, right. And I started going into this spiel about saying, well, look, if you look at the license, it says attributions. All you have to do is you know, credit me for the picture and you can use it anywhere you like. That's that. And she said, well, you know, I don't think we can put you into credits because normally that runs to quite a, you know, significant figure. And I was like, hang on a minute, because I was thinking still this is some like home movie.
Yeah.
Project. I was like, what is this film you want to use this picture in? And she said, well, we're currently shooting Iron Man with Robert Downey Jr. And I was like, what? I couldn't believe it. And then
let me change that license real quick.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Like, so, I mean, I probably could have, you know, got money for it, but I thought, oh, this is just too cool. I just like, yeah, sure. Use the picture. That's fine.
Yeah.
And my verbal agreement wasn't enough. And she had to like get it in writing, which involved her trying to fax things to the hotel.
Oh,
it got very complicated. But at some point I had my signature on something saying, yes, go ahead, use it, whatever. And I remember talking to her on the phone and saying like, oh, right, that picture. And it was the picture, blurry picture of Andy inside the VAB. And I thought, I get it, because normally you can't have access to the VAB, so there can't be that many pictures you could use. Is that why you're using it? And she said, oh, no, we just thought it was like a picture of a warehouse or something. You know, for all the troubles you got to track me down and get you could have just taken a picture of some other place and used it. My suspicion is what happened is that, you know, at this stage it was already in the film and it's rights clearance rather than, you know, get the permission first and then put it in the film. It's more like, okay, somebody's already done something with this picture and now we need to get the rights is probably what happened.
Mm.
I didn't even get to see Iron Man in the cinema when it came out for some reason. And it was later on, I was on an airplane and the film came on. I thought, oh yeah, Iron Man, my picture's supposed to be in that. And I thought, you know, it'll be one of those things where it's in the background for like, blurry and half a shot. There's no way I'll be able to recognize my picture in the film.
Yeah.
So I start watching it. And in the opening 2 minutes, two, 3 minutes, there's my picture really clear and really like up front. And it's that opening ceremony where Tony Stark's getting an award.
Yeah.
And there's a montage of magazine covers.
Yeah.
And one of the magazine covers has, you know, Robert Downey Jr. and Jeff Bridges photoshopped over my picture of the VAB. Which is just crazy. And it's on screen for a good 2 seconds, maybe, you know, which...
Oh, it's incredible.
Yeah, it was like, what? That's my picture. This is so crazy. So, yeah, that's how, you know, fairly crappy picture of mine ended up on Iron Man.
That's amazing, Jeremy. What a great story to kick off the episode with. I mean, that's so astonishing. I mean, even like you said, you probably could have gotten a few bucks for it, but I think just the sheer joy of knowing that that's there and it's there forever, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You know, in other situations, maybe I would have said, yeah, you know, I'm going to get paid for this. It's fine. But in this one, I was just like, oh no, this is kind of cool. I just use the picture and yeah, this will be a good story.
Your websites may not be here forever, but your picture in Iron Man will be.
Well, it depends how long the film storage lasts, you know, digital preservation matters there as well. Better than celluloid, probably, but yeah, we'll see.
What about net neutrality? If a certain group of people have their way, which they kind of have, I know that can be reversed, but if they have their way, then we're all going to be paying, like having to pay for internet. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a fundamental part of not, I guess, the technical structure of the internet, but also, I guess, the philosophical underpinnings of the internet, that it's just awful that it would be attempted to be reversed at this point.
Mm.
It was kind of the secret sauce when the internet was coming together. You know, there was a precursor to the internet, which was the ARPANET. It's mostly higher-level educational institutions having a network together. And later on, it was the ARPANET and other networks. So these networks need to be able to communicate, so there needs to be a way to have a network of networks, which is what the internetwork was. And the really, there was a couple of crucial sort of breakthroughs in the design of the internet. And one is this decentralized idea. You don't have this hub and spoke model. You don't have a centralized model that you can just keep adding to it. It's scale free. You can just keep adding. You don't have a centralized authority. And the other is this idea of packet switching, right? That you break down what you're trying to deliver over the network. You break it down into packets. And now all the network needs to do is deliver those packets via whatever route is most convenient at that moment. So that way, you know, nodes can get knocked out of the network and the packets will find another route. And here's the really crucial part of TCP/IP, you know, the really sort of low-level part of the way the internet works, is that the contents of the packet don't matter to the network. The network doesn't care about what's inside the packets. Nothing gets prioritized, nothing gets deprioritized. And that turns out to be an absolute genius, because if you had tried at that point, we're getting, you know, at this point we're into the 70s, heading towards the early 80s. If you tried to predict what to prioritize, you would have got it completely wrong, because you never would have foreseen that one day people would be sending, you know, video in a format that doesn't exist yet via the internet via these packets, right? Or some other format that didn't even exist at the time. So it was kind of a genius decision on the part of the architects of the internet to say, like, let's not prioritize for a particular kind of content. The content is irrelevant, and it's just about getting that content to where it needs to go as quickly as possible via packet switching. So it's really, really fundamentally baked in. And this is the funny thing with net neutrality, is that that's the way the internet works by default. You have net neutrality by default. You then, if you want to prioritize certain kinds of packets, certain kinds of content or content from a particular domain, you have to work at that. Like, you have to do more work to add on this extra level of complexity to say, well, we want to prioritize this sort of traffic and want to deprioritize that traffic. So it actually ends up becoming a cost to you if you're one of the people, you know, in charge of a part of the network. You're an ISP or something. It takes more work to not have net neutrality. So just from an engineering perspective, it seems kind of crazy. It's like, well, now you're just making more work for yourself. But also it's that fundamental problem is that, okay, well, let's say we lose net neutrality today, and ISPs or other companies will choose to prioritize certain kinds of content over others or deprioritize content. Well, the decision of what content counts as important will be made today, and then that can't possibly predict what will be important in the future, right? So the thing to do in that situation is don't try to predict the future. Don't try to anticipate what's going to be important in the future. Just treat everything equally. And that's what we got with the internet. And it's really, really short-sighted to try and figure out this is what's important because it just happens to be important to certain people today, right? We don't know the future value of things. Now, the thing with losing net neutrality in the States, because, you know, it's under fire in lots of different places. In the United States, it's a particularly bad situation because of lack of competition. For all that the United States is built on the ideas of capitalism and free market economies, where you have a level playing field in a free market and people compete on that free market, in certain areas, you've got complete monopolies. And one of those areas is in internet service providers. For a lot of people in a lot of the United States, they don't have any choice about where their internet comes from. They have to get it from, say, Comcast, or they have to get it from AT&T, and they don't have an opportunity to say, I don't agree with what this company is doing, so I'm going to take my business elsewhere, which is sort of a fundamental tenet of capitalism, is that you have, you know, the market decides, the market figures out. So what's happening right now is...
Right, and that's why the DOJ exists, right? To kind of, like, eliminate monopolies.
Exactly, right. It's like, stop... Exactly, get rid of monopolies, ensure a level playing field. Mm-hmm. And so this combination of losing net neutrality in combination with monopolies is a recipe for disaster, because it takes away the consumer's choice, the consumer's right to say, like, actually, I disagree with this decision, so I'll vote with my wallet.
Right.
I'll take my business elsewhere, which is the time-honored way that the consumer expresses, you know, pleasure or displeasure with the marketplace, is by moving business around. So it's particularly egregious, I think, in the United States.
Yeah.
And it would be great to see more players get into the ISP space. You know, you can imagine ethical ISPs, then all they do is provide the pipe and they don't try to prioritize traffic. I mean, you know, the net neutrality debate has been going on for a long time. And I remember over 10 years ago, at an event, and I wish I could remember who it was. Maybe it was J. David Eisenberg, but he wrote his whole poem about it, and it had a refrain, and everyone joined in the refrain for what we want from the internet, what you want from an ISP, and it was, fat pipe, always on, get out of my way. That's what you want from your internet service.
Nice.
Fat pipe, always on, get out of my way. And none of those things are particularly hard to provide. Also, we're talking about things that people want to pay money for, right? People are quite willing to fork over money for that pipe, always on, get out of my way.
I think Salter Kane could write us, take those lyrics and write a song about it.
Don't know if it would fit our style, you know. I don't know if we've ever done any overtly political songs. I don't actually know what our songs are about anyway, so.
You guys are great. I listened to some on iTunes. Yeah, it's good. You guys are really good. And, you know, you could, you know, use the subtle approach and kind of like, you know how like there's a lot of films that are really political, but you don't really know on the surface.
Yeah, we'll make a metaphor.
I don't know,
the river is the internet and the dam is, I don't know. We'll figure out some way of talking about net neutrality that's actually a murder ballad. Okay.
What's a dactio? What is that, Jeremy?
A dactio is a word, just a collection of characters strung together.
Okay.
It has a meaning in Latin, I believe. If your real question is why a dactio, then
yeah, sure.
It goes back to, so at the time I started getting online and started to have my own web presence, I was living in Germany, and I wanted a website that wasn't something in English, but also wasn't something in German. So I chose something that wasn't either and was, I think, just taken at random from Latin. But it doesn't mean anything. There's no particular origin story there, I'm afraid. It's just a bunch of characters that sounded good. You know, in retrospect, I should have gone for jeremykeith.com. That would have made sense, right? I seem to remember at the time, you know, it's like if you're beginning as a freelance web designer, like you'd almost try to pass yourself off as being an agency, even though it was just you, right? You
sure,
talk about
yeah.
we provide services, blah, blah, blah. And then there's no we, it's just one person making websites in their bedroom.
I'm so glad that writing has gotten more honest on the web and better, way better. It's like, you know, if you're an individual running your own freelance business, just come from that angle. People trust you more.
Well, I think in general, on this attitude to sort of being online used to, in the 90s into the early 2000s, used to be thought of as literally like another place. And so in this other place, you could be another person.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
You know, on the internet, no one knows you're a dog kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so people would have different personas. People would have, you know, the handle, the nickname that they use in your live journal account or whatever. And that's how you're known online.
Yeah.
And that's changed. And I think that's a good change that we no longer distinguish between online and offline identity, at least. I mean, there's maybe other things that we do need to draw a clear line. But I think in terms of identity, it's good that we don't draw a distinction. Because, you know, I remember trollish behavior being justified by people saying, oh, that's not what I'm like in real life. That's just me on the internet. You know, I'm like that on the internet. And you couldn't imagine anyone saying like, oh, I'm just like that on the telephone. You know, that's not me. That's just, I'm just an on the telephone.
Yeah.
But for some reason at the beginning, it was like, oh yes, I have this internet persona where, you know, this is my handle and I behave in this way. And it's very different to how I behave offline. It's funny, actually, I was talking to a friend of mine who used to work at Linden Lab, who built Second Life. And he's worked in a lot of interesting places where they have this idea of a separate sort of space you go to, like Second Life being an interesting one. And now he works in, you know, virtual reality stuff. And what he's come to realize over time is that it's not that, you know, you give people this alternate world where they can be anything and they can do anything and they could create a whole new identity, that actually what people tend to do is want to be themselves over a long enough time period. They might begin by saying, ah, yes, and in life I am a 40-year-old male, but I'm going to be, you know, a 20-year-old woman in this other space. But actually, no, over time people end up just wanting to be themselves in some alternate space. And I'm glad that in general, that's the way the internet has gone. It has its downsides in that, you know, if we're all being more honest and open, saying like, this is who I am, that makes it a lot easier for nefarious surveillance capitalist companies to say, ah, well, now we can more easily associate who you are on this site and on this site and on this site, and put all that information together and get this great picture of you so that we can track you across those sites and advertise to you. You know, part of that is made possible kind of by having a more honest identity, which is a real shame. It's like that those people are literally exploiting the fact that we're being more open and honest about our identities.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I feel like the internet, like any tool, really can be used for good or evil. I think there's, you know, and unfortunately, I think that there's always going to be folks who maybe aren't satisfied with their lives and maybe just are, you know, sad and just want to kind of be somebody else. And I think the internet, sadly, can afford them that. And unfortunately, there's the dark side of the web as well, which has, you know, it's not talked about that much, but it's not a good thing. You know, I mean, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think you're right there. I mean, there's the famous Mitch Kranzberg quote that, you know, technology is neither good nor bad, neither is it neutral.
Yes.
But I think to a certain extent you're right in that the internet, I would say most technology is an amplifier, right? And what it amplifies are existing structures. And what tends to happen is that whenever there's a new powerful technology that comes along, people think this won't be an amplifier, this will be a game changer. This will change the existing power structures. And there's this quite utopian, you know, viewpoint towards the new technology. And then over time, it turns out, no, what we ended up doing was solidifying existing structures even more because we've amplified them more. So this has happened time and time again. You know, when the telegram came along, truly world-changing technology, people thought that's the end of wars. You know, why would we go to war with a country when we can communicate instantly and solve our disagreements over telegraph? Radio, you know, it began as this medium to connect people at an amateur, you know, level, and then ended up being used for propaganda purposes and, you know, amplifying existing structures and becoming a broadcast medium, you know, that you broadcast to the masses. And sure enough, it's happened with the internet, where there's a lot of utopian thinking this will change everything. This will change how governments work. This will change how societies are structured. This will change how economies work. And change, yes, sure, but not fundamentally alter, you know, the ground rules. So again, it's amplifying. And it's funny, I was looking back at some things that Tim Berners-Lee, creator of the World Wide Web, said very early on. He's actually got a page on his website where he answers questions from kids. And this is from about 20 years ago. And they're actually really well written because he's writing back to kids, it's really clearly explained. And one of the questions he would get a lot is like, oh, is the web a force for good or is it a force for evil? And he was under no illusions that it was like this great thing that's automatically good. He's like, look, it's a technology, it amplifies.
Yeah.
And so it amplifies the bad as well as the good. So
yeah.
When we see the technology being used in a destructive way or in a way that reinforces a power structure we don't like, I was talking about, you know, surveillance capitalism being one example of that. Often I think what we try to do immediately is think, the problem's the technology and we need to fix the technology. But no, fixing technology isn't that hard a problem to solve. The really hard problem is that, no, there's a fundamental power imbalance below the technology, and that's what needs to be addressed. That turns out to be a really hard problem because, you know, generally going back often centuries to try and get to the root of where this imbalance came from. And it's messy and it's not as clean cut as, well, we'll just ship a patch for this thing, right? It involves people rather than technology, and people are messy. But yeah, so on the one hand, I agree, like, it's not like the internet is inherently bad or technology is inherently bad, but it's also not that the internet's inherently good or technology is inherently good. It's it's an amplifier. That doesn't absolve us of responsibility, though, to make sure that we, you know, build things in a responsible way. And part of that is just when we're building something that uses a technology, any technology really, that we ask, you know, kind of what's the worst that could happen? You know, what's the worst use that someone could put this technology to? And we don't just wash our hands and say, well, I'm just building technology. What people do with it isn't any of my concern. I think that's a bit of a cop-out. You have to actually address those concerns and then decide if you're going to take any actions to try and mitigate that. Maybe you can't fully prevent a technology from being used for nefarious purposes, but what can you do to mitigate that? And it gets into very gray areas. You know, if you're building if you're building something with end-to-end encryption, that's very good for privacy. I would say it's not going to subvert power structures, but it's at least a way for people to communicate, you know, off the grid effectively. But people who want to communicate off the grid may want to do some very nefarious things too. Is the solution there to ban end-to-end encryption? Absolutely not. It's a vital technology, but there's certainly moral gray areas. Generally, the solution is very, very rarely is the solution ban the technology. That generally doesn't work. However, the solution can often be regulate the technology, which is anathema to a lot of people, I think, in the technology world. This idea of regulation feels like, oh, that's so 20th century that we'd have, you know, government, slow-moving government deciding to regulate things.
Yeah.
But frankly, and I'd rather that we didn't have to regulate if we didn't have to, but this is why we can't have nice things, right? You've been given free rein to do what you want on the internet, and boy, it's turned into a mess. So, okay, I'm sorry. We tried. Time for some regulation.
Yeah, and I think you said it. It's a very gray area. It's a very fine line. But I do think, I agree with you, I think that there is some onus on the creators of these products, especially ones that maybe people are forming unhealthy addictions to, perhaps. There could be a little bit of room for, like, you know, kind of being that sort of non-judgmental, but hey, I know you've been on the gambling, our gambling product for a while, like, maybe, hey, do you want to, like, go outside for a little bit? And, you know, like...
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, that is a design decision.
Yes.
So what you described there is a design decision. The problem is what you're measuring, right? Or how are you going to decide whether a design decision is quote-unquote good or quote-unquote bad? Well, to do that, you need to have some metric you're measuring. Mm. And if that metric goes up, it was a good design decision. If the metric goes down, it's a bad design decision. That sounds very crude, but that's actually the way a lot of design decisions get made. You do something like A-B testing and you say, this design decision did better than that design decision. And by better, you mean there was higher, say, engagement. You know, more people stuck around, more people completed a transaction. Now, if that's the metric you're looking at, that's not the same metric as, is it doing good for people or is it good for the particular person? You know, just recently, there was a lot of travel agent sites here in Europe got slapped with some fines because they were using all sorts of what I would describe as dark patterns to kind of hassle the user to complete transactions. Like, oh, four other people are looking at this hotel room, or you've only got 5 minutes left to complete this transaction. Now, but if you A-B tested those patterns, you'd find that they convert better, that it, you know, lit a fire under people and they're like, oh, I better do this. But it would also have made people really stressed out. In fact, one of my friends tweeted, it's like, my heart rate was going up while he was trying to book a hotel room.
Oh, wow.
It was like, oh, you better complete it soon.
Cortisol level spiking.
Exactly. So if the measurement you're measuring is simply the numbers on a spreadsheet of like, oh, we got more profit this month and we got, you know, engagement, or the classic one, stakeholder value, then there's no incentive in the design process to add in the kind of patterns that you're talking about, where it's like, well, it would be better for the user if at this point we asked them to maybe take a break, or it'd be better for the user if at this point we suggested that they, you know, don't use our product for a while.
Yeah.
There's very few incentives for that. Now, I personally think that actually there are good profitability reasons to do those kind of patterns, that you end up with a better goodwill from the user in the long term, that they will,
yes,
you know, they'll tell their friends that this is something that happened. It's really unusual. You have a bit of a first mover advantage to you know, do stuff ethically. Can be absolutely a competitive advantage there. But the tricky thing is measuring that. Like,
yeah,
well-being is a tricky thing to measure. It can't be measured in the same way that, you know, clicks or hits or any of that kind of stuff can be measured. And it's generally not what's being tested against. So yeah, metrics lie at the heart of a lot of this kind of spiral where I think design decisions that kind of do harm or can do harm get implemented through no malice on the part of the designer. They're not trying to, you know, make the user's life worse. If anything, they might think they're doing something good, but because they're looking at the wrong metrics or incomplete metrics, then yeah, it gets judged as being a good decision when actually it could be downright harmful. I'm kind of talking vague generalities, I know, but it's a pattern I kind of see over and over again, where at some point we stop asking the why, you know, so like, why? Because it'll increase revenue. Okay, that's all we need to know. If this will increase revenue, do it. And we don't keep asking, well, what's the knock-on effect? What happens then? What happens to the user after they've bought this product, but they've been through this, you know, nerve-wracking process to do it? Then it is incumbent on designers, I feel, to be the proxy voice for the user in that situation, to say, yes, the metric of profitability or something else, that's an important one, but hey, here's this other metric over here, and it's the well-being of the user, and this is something we need to consider, and we need to balance it, and they are not in conflict. I mean, it's absolutely possible to, you know, have a design that's doing its job well and is profitable and is, and people are completing, and not stress people out at the same time, or not do things that over the long term would, you know, make the user feel worse and worse. I might be idealistic of me, but I don't think they're in conflict. I don't think it's either you have a cutthroat approach to this stuff, or you have this nice hippy-dippy, feely attitude to things. No, I think you can absolutely combine the two things together and have a balanced approach to design.
Coming soon from Envision, the design collaboration platform used to create the digital products you love. Envision Studio, the world's most powerful screen design tool. Unlock new dimensions of screen design with Envision Studio's new adaptive layout engine, rapid prototyping, advanced animation, shared design systems, and other game-changing features created to help your team design better, faster, together. Clark from Envision says, "This is the design tool we've always wanted, and we're so excited to share it with you." Visit userdefenders.com/studio to get early access.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot, philosophy, Jeremy. And I think about Tristan Harris's work. He founded Time Well Spent. He's a former Googler, and he's done some other stuff in tech. And he's sort of defected, so to speak, in a way, from a lot of kind of what software is doing now, especially a lot of these addictive apps. And, you know, there's an article in The Atlantic that I haven't read yet, but it's been in my tabs for about 3 months. One of these days I'll get to it. But one of the pull quotes is, he says, "A Hippocratic oath for software designers would stop the exploitation of people's psychological vulnerabilities." And I think that's a really interesting and quite challenging and controversial thing to put out there. But I don't know. I just feel like, you know, that there's a value to that. And I think, as you touched on, I think software companies and developers and designers even would benefit a lot if they would kind of think about this a little more, especially if they're designing something to be addictive for that purpose. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I agree. And that analogy of the Hippocratic Oath is, I think, a very valid one. In fact, Jonathan Harris, no relation to Tristan Harris, He wrote about this specifically a while back. We compared software to medicine in terms of the impact it has on people and people's lives. Like, in a day-to-day person's life, they're going to interact with software in order to live their life, right? Get stuff done, get from A to B, buy something, do something, communicate, involve software. So the responsibility on the people who make that software, the people who design and develop it, is actually really big. And I think what's happened is that our mental model, as a society, our mental model of software engineers is still stuck somewhere back in the past, where it's like, oh, it's a nerdy thing that's done. It's kind of a hobby. It's kind of maybe something that's a harmless thing you indulge, and a certain kind of person does it. It's not for everyone, right? I think that's very harmful, one, to the industry, you know, and we want as many different kinds of people as possible making software. But two, it is a real mismatch there in power, because you couldn't imagine people talking about doctors that way and saying, like, oh, well, you know, it's kind of a hobby thing. And, you know, when you need to get checked out, and it doesn't really matter who you see, you know. No, for medicine, we have, you know, strict guidelines. And as you say, a Hippocratic Oath, I could absolutely see something like that being required, really, for software development, because the impact we have is you know, so impactful on people's lives. Not that I don't think it's to the same extent as, say, doctors, teachers, people like that, but still makes a big impact on people's lives, and so that requires a big responsibility.
Yeah.
But what you get in other industries is you get a situation where there's maybe like a baseline agreed standard of, like, or a red line we won't cross. Like, you can ask us to do stuff, but we all agree we'll never do X. Now, getting agreement on what that line is going to be really hard, right? And maybe it's different for every person. Maybe it's different for every company. I definitely, you know, I've talked to people who've worked at places that have done, I don't know, maybe not black hat practices, but gray hat practices. And usually whenever somebody brings up the mortgage defense, you know that they're basically doing something they're not proud of. It's like, you know, I press them and I'm like, but you know what you're doing there? That seems really dodgy. And say, yeah, well, it pays the bills and I've got a mortgage to pay.
Uh-oh.
Right. And that's like, oh,
right.
That can literally justify anything. You know, you can do that if you're an arms manufacturer, you can tell yourself that as well. If you're making electric chairs, you can tell yourself you've got a mortgage to pay, right? Now, the tricky thing is that, like, drawing that line and saying this is a line we won't cross collectively as an industry across countries, that's going to be really hard. Mm-hmm. But what you do get in other areas is people having each other's back within a discipline, within an industry. This is pretty much what trade unions are about, to prevent exploitation, to just knowing that somebody's got your back. Now, I'm not saying that we need to have literally the same structure as traditional trade unions, but some kind of way that when the boss says, hey, I want you to do this thing, that you would feel, if not comfortable, then at least, you know, in a position to say, I'm not going to do that. I refuse to do that. Now, as it is today, you can do that, and the boss goes, okay, good for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
And I've done that, by the way.
It's always a test of the principles, right? If your principles are never tested, you know, how valuable are they really? But yeah, if you do that, I mean, a lot of people, if they do that at their workplace and they say, I can't do that, I refuse to do that, they say, okay, fine, you're fired, and we'll bring in another developer who will do that. So the idea of the, you know, a union in that situation, we go, whoa, you can't fire the person for that reason, and there are consequences to that. I'm not saying a union model is the way to go, but it's just some kind of way of having each other's back. And that's why I feel like the Hippocratic Oath idea is an interesting one, because an employer would know full well when you're joining, like, you, that this employee has signed up to this oath and the certain things they will or won't do. And it just seems to make sense from a practical point of view of culpability as well. And in the Volkswagen case of rigging test results, emissions tests, the engineers who wrote the code have been found legally culpable, whatever about morally culpable, legally culpable for that. So it's not just the, you know, I was only doing what I was told, I was only obeying orders part of it, and that it's the people making the decisions who are at fault. There is now a legal precedent that the code you write can be used against you in a court of law.
Wow.
Now, that's a fairly...
That's one I never thought I'd hear.
You're right. The code you write can be used against you in a court of law. Maybe we should all get read our rights when we start a new project.
My goodness.
But, you know, where do you draw that line is the interesting thing, because, I mean, that's fairly clear. Being asked to rig an emissions test, everyone would agree that's pretty dodgy, but...
Oh, yeah.
You know, when you're asked to add the 20th tracking script to a page, mm-hmm. like, is that the straw that breaks the camel's back, where you say, no, this is going too far, you know? Or is it the first one? Is it being asked to add any kind of surveillance JavaScript to a web page? Is that the point you say, I'm not going to do that?
Yeah.
Very tricky to say. And of course, I realize I'm in a position of privilege to be able to say, like, well, I would draw the line here and I would refuse and I would get by. And if I got fired for refusing to do something, I'd be able to get another job, or I'd be able to support myself. You know, I'm sure I wouldn't be risking everything. Whereas other people in that situation, they would. You know, they really would be risking everything to stand up and say, no, I'm not going to do that. Hence why I feel like we need to have each other's back. But I have no specific suggestions as to how to do it. But I'm definitely paying attention to people like Tristan Harris and what he's talking about, in particular, because I find he's really not that militant. You know, he's not talking about really extreme stuff. He's actually being very even-handed and balanced about stuff. I know some people in this field they can get very militant, either, you know, you're with us or against us when it comes to this kind of stuff, and I don't think that helps. And yeah, Tristan is just talking about small things, small interface things.
He's starting a conversation.
Exactly.
He started a conversation.
Think about it.
And he's making, and like, he's offering solutions. That's what I like. He's not just saying, here's a problem. He's saying, here's some solutions. Why aren't we doing this? And so I guess that would be kind of my, you know, and you kind of mentioned it, you know, it's like, I don't know what the answer is. But it's like, if you could say something to software developers, to designers listening to this right now that are maybe part of this, you know, kind of creating addictive products, maybe all for profit, and you're not really thinking about the moral implications or the ethics behind it. Like, what would you say to those folks?
I don't know. I guess just being aware of it, just having it in your mind is a big step. Just even realizing the problem exists is a huge part of it. I've noticed this in other areas too. You know, I talk about digital preservation and longevity, and just even having that in your mind can change then how you would approach building something, how you approach architecting something. But I think just being the awareness of the problem is part of it. Also, you can try to live it. You know, like you said, Tristan has these very practical guidelines for, you know, anyone, no matter what your role is, in life, to just avoid the nasty side effects. And then if you can pass that on to other people, like one of the ones he talked about, it turned out I was doing anyway. And I hadn't, but I hadn't phrased it the way that he put it, which I thought, oh, that's really smart. He said that so you have notifications on your mobile device. He said, try only enabling notifications to come from humans. And I thought about it, and I realized, oh, that's what I'm doing, because like I'll get notified if there's a, you know, iMessage or text message or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'll get notified, I think, if I got a DM on Twitter, but everything else I've got switched off. Like any app that wants to send me, hey, you know, there's a new thing just happened. Somebody posted a new picture. Somebody did blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no, that's not, I'm not going to enable notifications for that. And I hadn't been thinking about it in those terms, but when I read what he wrote, I was like, oh, that's exactly what I'm doing. For these other things,
yeah,
I want to be able to go to the app and then say, now I want to see what's happened. Now I want to you to show me who's posted what on this social network. But I don't want you to be impinging on my life by telling me that stuff. Now, here's the interesting thing is that, so as an example, like I said, I do have notifications for DMs on Twitter, but not for Twitter in general. I definitely don't want to be notified every time someone, you know, likes or retweets or just says something.
Yeah.
But let's say I use Swarm and I use Instagram. In those, I've switched off notifications completely.
Nice.
Now, the problem is when I do open up those apps, and I do use them, and I go in and, you know, but it's more like I go to them rather than them pulling me in.
Yes.
I open them up to see what's happened, and they always, there's this persistent thing saying, you should enable notifications. And I dismiss it, and then it just comes back. Like the next time I open it,
don't
it comes
remind
up.
Me again. Okay, I won't until three more sessions.
Right. And it's like, I'm trying to do good here. I've made a decision. This is how I'm going to live my life. I'm going to not enable notifications.
Yeah.
And for to have the apps going like, you should enable notifications. It's kind of like if you're trying to quit something and you've got a friend who keeps going like, go on, have one, just one. It won't do you any harm. And it's like...
Exactly.
And that is a design decision. Now, in that case, I submitted bug reports in the hope that the behavior I was seeing was not by design, but like, oh, I don't know if you realize, but it, no matter how many times I dismiss this notification asking me to enable, you know, notifications, it keeps coming back. I'm sure this is a bug, so just want you to be aware of it. But the cynical side of me will say that that's not a bug. Like that is absolutely a designed feature. Because again, if the metric they're looking for is, you know, engagement, then I'm sure engagement is higher for people who have notifications turned on for everything.
Yep.
But the other metric of, you know, people's well-being, their health,
mm-hmm.
that metric is probably not doing so good, but that's a harder one to measure.
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely agree. And, you know, and I appreciate this conversation because I really didn't, I am going to talk about web design, Jeremy.
Okay.
But I really appreciate, you know, hearing your input on this. I think it's an important issue. It is certainly not one that's talked about that much. And I think,
I see it happening more and more, I have to say. I mean, I would say a few years ago, it wasn't talked about at all.
Yeah.
And then you had, you know, Eric Meyer and Sarah Wachter-Betcher wrote their book together, The Book Apart, which is fantastic. And now you got people, you know, Mike Montero talks about this stuff. He's kind of like the Old Testament preacher. You know, Tristan Harris is being all very like, you know.
That's a good analogy.
Some practical things. Mike Montero's like banging on the table saying enough is enough.
Yeah.
Maciej Sikorski on Idle Words. He runs Pinboard. He's doing a lot of really good work in this area. Again, just get people to think about this stuff. Just realize it's an issue. And Kenneth Bowles, who used to work at Clear Left, he's currently writing a book on the stuff and speaking about this stuff at conferences. Laura Kalbag's another person who, you know, talks about about this kind of stuff. So more and more, I have to say, I see it happening. So
yeah,
again, it's kind of a hot topic. If you want to be on trend in web design and development, then ethics in design is a hot topic.
Yeah, I fully agree. So designers, developers, CEOs, I mean, like just anybody building software, anybody building products, like please just think about that. Think about that next time or even now, I mean, in the midst of your project, to think about what can you do to think about your users. I think, and here's my last thing I'll say on this, and I guess my ultimate takeaway on this is have more empathy. Just think about, you know, put yourself in your user's shoes. And isn't that kind of what this field's about anyway? We're building software, we're building products for other people primarily. So think about that, build your empathy up and allow yourself to kind of to be in their shoes. I think that's going to make a really big difference when it comes to ethics and software and things.
I agree.
You wrote a book. Another one.
I wrote another one. Stop me before I write again.
No, please keep going. It's incredible. It's called Resilient Web Design. I just finished the book and it's amazing.
Okay.
And guess what, Defenders? It's at the incredible price of free. Why did you do that, Jeremy?
I didn't put that much thought into it. I had this book kind of inside me, I guess. You know, I was doing lots of conference talks on these topics, and I was like, I need to tie these strands together and put them into a book form. But instead of like going to a publisher and saying, hey, here's an idea for a book, you know, should we do this together? I thought, I'll write it first and then see if somebody wants to publish it. And I was kind of thinking, you know, it could be a book apart because size-wise, it's very, very short.
That's true.
So I wrote it first and then was like, hey, you know, Jeffrey, I've written this book. What do you think? And he's like, it doesn't really fit with the book apart, you know, style or, you know, a topic done really in depth. And I was like, yeah, that's true. So I was like, yeah, well, what will I do with this? And I thought, you know, I could just put the thing online. And I didn't think that much about it. And again, it was kind of like we were talking about earlier with net neutrality. If I wanted to charge for it, it was actually going to take a lot of work. I have to figure out, okay, how am I going to do that? How am I going to take the money? I was like, you know, it'd be very simple if I literally just put it out there. And I said, you know, I was asking myself what I wanted to get out of it. And in this case, monetary gain. I have nothing against making money. I like making money a lot, but it wasn't the reason I wrote the book. And I thought, you know, okay, for this one, I'll just put it out there for free. And if I'm doing that, I thought, well, the licensing as well, I think should just be as liberal as possible. So, you know, Creative Commons. And yeah, I thought it would also be kind of fun to do that, to have a book that's not just like, oh, there's a web version, but the web version is the book. Like the version that you get to by visiting the URL, resilientwebdesign.com, is the book.
Yeah.
And there are other versions available. You can download a PDF. Somebody made an EPUB version, which is great.
Yep, that's what I have.
Right, there you go. Then somebody, you know, because of the licensing, somebody could do that, which is just wonderful. But the canonical version is at this URL. And that was really fun to do. And then to think about, well, how does that influence the building of the website, you know, knowing that this is for a book that's also a website. And, you know, I had a lot of fun building, I guess, the website / book, you know, designing it and building it. That was a lot of fun. It was certainly more fun doing that than doing the actual writing, I would say, because, you know, writing takes a long time and it's hard. And then it was like this, oh, I'm going to play around with CSS and HTML and JavaScript. Okay, this is fun again. So there wasn't a particular, you know, there wasn't much of a thought process behind it. Just, I'm going to try this. I'll try throwing one out there for free. Yeah, it was an experiment.
I think it's great. And Defenders, check it out. I'm going to be sure to link to it in the show notes, of course. But it is an entire history lesson on the web, on the World Wide Web.
Which I didn't intend when I started writing it. You know, that's the
really?
Funny thing. I just started writing to see where... I knew there were ideas in there I wanted to get across about how you make resilient web websites, you know, a way of thinking about building for the web.
Yes.
But I wasn't sure how to get there. And the more I was writing, I started just getting a lot of my own interests, you know, things that fascinate me. And I realized a lot of the things that fascinate me are historical. It's about, hey, remember when we were doing websites like this? And we can learn from the past. And so there's a lot of that, of looking at the past to learn from it. Looking at lessons we've learned, you know, over and over again, seeing cycles repeat. But yeah, it's funny, I didn't intend it to be that kind of, yeah, people's history of web design. It kind of just turned into it.
It totally is. And the thing I love about that, and the reason I love sharing that, is because there's a lot of defenders listening right now who are really new in the craft and kind of just finding their way and kind of figuring out what area they really like in this field. And because there's, as you know, there's just so many different things you could do to build products and to build great websites. So, but I think that's what I love about it. And that's why I want to encourage you, defenders listening, go to the URL, grab the EPUB or I think there's an Android version, right? And you can just read it right on the website too, which is totally like in character for Jeremy, because it's all about the URLs and being able to access it from anywhere. So I just love it. Check it out, defenders. It is an entire history of the web, but he did it in a really succinct way. But he gave you just enough, and I love that, Jeremy. Great job on this.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for doing it.
Actually, if you visit the URL on a device with a browser that supports service workers, then just visiting the URL pretty much installs the book.
Oh, no way.
On your device. So. You can be on an airplane, you know, with no internet connection and still reading the online version of the book, because it's all working offline.
Oh, I love that, man. That's so true to form with you, you know? And I mean, you preach what you practice. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's also just something I'm fascinated by. Right now, I'm like obsessed with service workers. Like, it's really fascinating technology. And I'm like, oh, I just want to play with them. So it was a really nice opportunity to have a play around.
That's so cool. You know, I don't know many more passionate about the web than you, Jeremy. Why do you love the web so much?
Gosh, that's a good question. It's funny because we were talking earlier about how the technologies and a medium like the web, it's not good or bad. It just amplifies. And that's absolutely true.
Yes.
Having said that, I've seen it amplify so many good things, you know. I mean,
yes.
And it goes back to where it came from, right? It's about getting people to collaborate together. You know, initially it's at CERN and it's a bunch of scientists trying to collaborate together. You scale that up and it still works. You know, people can exchange information across the country, across the world. That's quite amazing. And then I think about the implications on somebody who's maybe historically you would have been trapped by geography. Let's say you're living in a little village in a country and you're different to other people in the village for whatever reason. And you don't feel like you got someone you can relate to or talk to. And in the past, it would have been kind of tough luck. And you would have been able to find refuge in books, you know, reading things other people have written in the past. But to suddenly have this medium where you could connect with people on the other side of the world who are like you, who are going through what you're going through, and to be able to communicate with them, to be able to, you can express something, right? You put your thoughts out there at a URL and then have somebody else find that URL, read your thoughts and respond to you. That's really powerful, still really powerful today, whether it's about, hey, here's this cool thing I've built.
Yes.
Or whether it's, hey, here's a thought I've had about something, or whether it's, this is how I'm feeling. The web is just very good at that, this combination. There's lots of technologies on the internet. The web is just one technology running on the internet, right? And there's lots of technologies on the internet that are very good at instant communication, right? The web can do that, but there's other technologies that are better, right? You know, FaceTime or SMS, or all these other technologies that basically run over the web, over the internet.
Yeah.
And the web can kind of do a bit of everything, which is where its strength is. Like, so it can do that more or less real-time chat if you want to do it. But then once you bring URLs into it, that's the web's superpower, that you can put something at this address. And that address now, you could, if you take care of it, can last through time and be there not just for the instant communication, say, hey, I wrote this thing just now and someone can read it right now, but that someone could read that in 5 years' time or 10 years' time or 15 years' time, and that could influence them. And then they put something online. Maybe it's not words, maybe it's video, maybe it's images, maybe it's audio. But once something has a URL, something about that's very powerful to me. And I kind of wish I got more excited about other technologies, but I just don't get as excited about things if they don't have URLs, right? I remember when, you know, the iPhone came along and then a year later, the App Store, and people getting very excited. And I was like, I wish I could get as excited about building, say, native apps, because it looks similar to web design, you know, in a lot of ways, but it's got different constraints. But it's like, I'm just not that into it because there's no URL. So I'm like, well, what's the point? And in a way, I feel like a real old-fashioned fuddy-duddy when I put it like that. You know, it's like, if it doesn't have a URL, it's, it ain't worth nothing. And that's not
get
what I mean.
Get off my lawn.
Yeah. URLs are GTFO. Whereas that's not the way I mean it. Like, I'm saying, like, I think the problem lies with me. It's like, why have I got this thing for the web in particular? And to me, the web is URLs, right? So when we talk about the web, we could be talking about the web technologies, HTML, CSS, JavaScript. But I also think those can evolve and change and even go away. And the web would still be the web because of URLs. That's what the web has that other technologies don't. And I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is about that's so powerful to me. In fact, I'm spending a lot of my time questioning myself these days. And like, what is it? Why is it you get excited about some things and you don't get excited about other things? Like, what's wrong with you? You know, you read these articles about, you know, web developers. Every web developer should be really excited about. And then there's a list of 10 new tools or frameworks or libraries or something. I'm like, I don't think I'm excited about any of those things. Like, what's wrong with me? But then I will find something I do get excited about. You know, I was mentioning service workers. I'm like, oh, wait, no, I do still have this capacity to get really into something and want to talk about it and want to share. But I've been kind of trying to analyze myself and figure out, like, why do some things fall into the first category and others into the second category? I haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah, I just think about, like, the community. And I wonder, and maybe it's so bold as to assume that perhaps the answer is just that it's about people for you. That it's the web is for everybody, right? There's no gatekeepers, really. I mean, they're trying to be, but there's still, like you say, you can put your stake in the ground, put your, you know, your sold real estate sign on the ground of your website, and you own that. You own that content, you know, I mean, and
yeah,
anywhere else you publish, and we all love to publish on a Medium or Facebook or Twitter or whatever, that's not really our content. Somebody else owns that.
That's absolutely true, yeah. No, I'm very much about the owning your own content and having your place on the web. Now, to be fair, you never really own a domain. I mean, we were talking about centralization, decentralization, and, you know, ICANN domain name system does mean that we rent domain names. We never own them.
It's like owning a house. You don't really own it until the last mortgage payment. Exactly. I'll probably be dead before I pay off my house.
The bank owns the house. But still, there's an order of magnitude difference between that and, you know, publishing directly to somebody else's website, like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg's website or Ed Williams' website or Jack Dorsey's website. There's a difference. It's kind of a difference in feeling, right? There's a difference of feeling. Like, it feels good to publish on your own site.
Yeah.
It feels different to publish on somebody else's. It's easy to publish on somebody else's, and that's something we need to work on for publishing on your own website, is how do we make it as easy as it is to publish on somebody else's. But there's a feeling where, like, yeah, you know, they can change the rules from one day to the next and you're at the mercy of those rules. So when Twitter decides, yeah, we're going to change what tweets you see, or Instagram says, yeah, we decided that the timeline is going to be ordered by a secret algorithm that you don't know. There's nothing you can do about that, right? Because you've pitched your tent in their backyard.
Yeah, you're building on rented land.
Yeah, there's a nice feeling to doing it on your own site. Yeah. Now, what I tend to do is, like, it's not like I hoard everything on my own site. I don't let anybody else at it. It's like I publish things to my own site first, and then I syndicate out to these places, syndicate to Medium and Twitter and Facebook.
Yes.
Kind of like with the book. Like I said, like, the canonical thing is the URL, but hey, you want it in Mobi or EPUB or whatever? Sure, there you go. I kind of think of it like RSS. You know, years ago we'd syndicate with RSS, and you can read that wherever you want to, however you want to. It's kind of the same. Like, do it however you want. However, the canonical URL, and this goes back to the power of URLs, the URL is something that I've decided, you know. And how long that URL will exist when I put something online at URL, that's my decision now. I'm not saying everything will be online forever that I publish, but at least I'll be able to decide when I want to take it offline, rather than having that decision made for me. You know, that the history of the web is littered with sites where people poured their heart out and gave their hearts and souls to these websites. And then those websites get bought up by a bigger player and they say, oh, great news, we're shutting down and deleting all your data, right? And that's a terribly disempowering feeling when that happens. So yeah, there is absolutely something about having a place of your own on the web that you published. I wish more people would do it. I understand that there's a friction to it, trying to work on ways to bring that friction down. And part of that is, you know, sharing. You talk about the web being people, and you're absolutely right. You know, when Tim Berners-Lee created the web, himself and his colleague Robert Caillou, they kind of had to have a publicity campaign for it within CERN to convince people to use it. You know, this is a good idea, you should use it. And part of that is, you know, making sure that the technologies were easy enough to use and familiar enough to use. But also, it was literally like a PR push for the web. And they had stickers, and they had a slogan. And the slogan was, let's share what we know, which I think is, you know, perfect for a scientific institution. And frankly, it's a pretty good thing to scale up and apply to the whole world. Let's share what we know. And the best of the web is people sharing what they know. You know, when I got into web design, the web had already been around for a few years. And I thought, how am I going to learn how to make websites? Well, turns out lots of people were sharing what they knew. They were publishing on the web.
Yes.
Jeffrey Zeldman had Ask Dr. Web.
Yes.
And he shared what he knew about building websites. There was a web design mailing list run by Steve Champion. You know, Eric Meyer would have a CSS mailing list, and people were just writing on their blogs.
A list apart.
Yeah, exactly. List apart back when it was literally a mailing list.
Yes.
And so people were sharing. And so then when I began to learn and I would figure something out and I'd, you know, get better at something, it just felt natural that what I should do is share that.
Yes.
That I should put it out there and say, hey, here's something I figured out, or here's something I'm thinking about, or here's something I'm interested in. And it feels like it's the default setting for the web is to share. Like, if you figure something out, you share it.
Yes.
And that was even back in the day, just before we had, you know, GitHub, where you could fork other people's code, or CodePen, where you can make a reduced test case and just put something up. You know, it's easier than ever, I think, these days to share what you know. Yeah, long may it continue that people share, you know.
Hi, I'm Matt Griffin. I try to make things less terrible, and I fight for the users. You're listening to User Defenders Podcast with Jason Ogle.
Oh, love it. I couldn't agree more, Jeremy. And that's why I started this podcast. And I'm a little late to the party. I absorbed other people's content, like a lot of the folks you mentioned. I've absorbed their content for many years. And that was really stepping stones for my career. I mean, I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for these generous people sharing what they know and you know, and putting out, you know, the things that they've learned. And I mean, and thank God for Google too. I mean, Google's made this quest a lot easier for us to find exactly what we need. But you're right. Like, I don't know of any other community that is so eager to share and to help others, help their peers to grow and to do better. Like, you know, I was just thinking, like, I'm trying to replace a toilet right now in my house and I'm having the hardest time. It's not just like the wax ring is, you know, it's not just that. It's that the stinking flange broke. And it's glued, like super, like welded to the actual pipe and everything. Sorry if you guys are getting grossed out by this, but I'm going somewhere with this. And so here I am. I'm not a craftsman of home repairs. I'm not. I wish I were. But for one, it gave me empathy for those folks doing this, the plumbers that have spent many years apprenticing and journeyman and becoming a master at this stuff, where it's like, oh yeah, you know, walk in the park for those guys. But then I realized about our craft too. It's like, you know, that's kind of, we need to not undervalue our skills because we are the crafts people of this trade. And we've spent many years. There's a story about Pablo Picasso where somebody noticed him in a park and they're like, hey, can you paint a picture of my son or whatever? And he's like, sure. And he spent, like, he did it 5 minutes. He painted it. And then he handed it to the lady and he said, that'll be $50,000. And she said, what? You only spent 5 minutes on that. He said, no, my dear, I've spent 50 years on this, doing this. You know, so it's kind of that idea about being a craftsperson. But you know, coming back to the web and the generosity.
Well, you know, I have to say, Jason, that's probably not the first time that, you know, web design has been compared to fixing toilets, and it probably won't be the last. But
here's where I'm going with that.
I'm glad you brought it back to you know what? Go with the Pablo Picasso analogy. It sounds way more noble when you put it like that,
okay,
than the toilet analogy.
But the end of my toilet story, though, I do have a kind of an ending to this about the web, and I'm sorry, folks. Stay tuned. I'm going to continue here. It's going to get better. When a plumber learns something new, I don't know if there's like a community. I mean, I'm sure there are, but I just feel like it's one of those things where, like, when we learn something new on the web, like we get out there and share it. I doubt that when a plumber learns a new thing, he immediately goes to the web and shares. In general, immediately goes and shares and brings a community of plumbers together to try to make things better. Like, you know, I don't know. Maybe that's an assumption, but I just feel like that's one of the things I love about the web so much, is that it is such a community. It's such a generous community. And I've learned that over 2 years of doing this show, of talking to wonderful guests like you, you know, that come on, are just so generous to share. And you have a free book that we can learn so much from as well. So,
well, thank you. But I mean, I do think if the web were only good for people who are building websites to share stuff, I think it would have failed. But the fact that, you know, people can share anything on the web is what kind of makes it great. So if plumbers do want to share tips with other plumbers,
yeah,
that's, the web's the perfect place to do that. You know, whether it's in video form or text or audio, images, you know, that you know, it's, you need to bake a cake. Somebody who's really into baking cakes has shared all this information.
And yeah.
I, to be honest, that kind of excites me more than just, you know, web designers and web developers sharing tips. That's kind of you'd almost expect that the web is going to be used for that purpose by people who build a web, that the obvious medium for sharing this stuff is the web.
Yeah.
It's kind of more interesting when you find really, really, really obscure things that there's this whole sub-community about, like there's people who are really into fixing toilets and they've got this whole social network about fixing toilets and it's on the web and it's this whole community.
Yeah.
That's when I think the web sort of comes into its own, when it's the niche stuff. Mm. You know, we tend to concentrate on the big success stories on the web, like, you know, the Facebooks, the Googles, the big players. But
yeah,
I get much more excited by the small things, you know, the smaller communities, the things that have been ticking along for years, and people are very happy there and they're sharing, and it's, yeah, that's what really excites me.
That's awesome. I'm so glad you said that, Jeremy. And I'm going to kind of go back and sort of retract what I said about, you know, plumbers not sharing, because you can go on YouTube and you can learn how to do pretty much any repair you need to by typing in a few keywords. And there are very generous craftspeople who are sharing what they know and showing you how to do it. Some, of course, obviously a lot better than others with cameras and lightings and all that. But I mean, just the fact that they take the time, that people are taking the time to do that and share is, I think that's what makes the web so incredible.
Right. I remember the first time I was kind of getting on the web and, you know, you're getting lost going down these rabbit holes of websites that people have put together. And, you know, it wasn't very professional, but that didn't matter. You know, somebody's GeoCities page, somebody's fan page, didn't matter. And I remember showing this to my friend Chris, who's the singer in Salt of Cain. And it was like, you know, look, somebody's made a fan page for that band you really like.
Yeah.
And look at all the information on it and the images and the stuff you can get for free on this website. And he was, his question was like, but why? Why are they doing this? You know, there's no monetary gain to be had for doing this. Why would somebody spend the time to build this thing?
That is really interesting.
It was interesting because I hadn't even thought of that question of like, oh yeah, why would somebody do that? It's just like, oh, well, because they really like that band and they're sharing their enthusiasm. And there is a reward that comes from just connecting with people who share your interests. And I think the more obscure and niche your interest is, the greater the reward when you make that connection with somebody, you know, in another country or another part of the world who shares your connection, right? It's like, oh, I'm really into that thing too. Yeah, that's when the web really shines.
Absolutely. We're getting closer to the end of our time, sadly. I could talk to you for hours more, Jeremy. And I felt like the same way we had our Event Apart lunch. You know, we got to sit at the same table and that was just so awesome.
Yeah, that was fun.
But it was like all of a sudden it's like, oh, shoot, we got to go hear Derek Featherstone. We get to go hear Derek Featherstone. It was an incredible talk, by the way.
Well, I believe I said like, yeah, you don't want to miss this one. Don't miss the talk. Yeah.
Yeah. And Derek's going to be a future guest. I'm really excited about that. Again,
oh, great,
speaking
great.
About making a web for everybody. And I love that he's really champion the accessibility side of that as well. So I had a former super guest, Matt Griffin, and he made a terrific film about the web.
Yeah.
And I believe you were in, Jeremy. It's called What Comes Next is the Future, which is also free.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Another generous soul. Jeremy, what do you think does come next?
Oh.
And don't say the future.
No, this is interesting because I've been thinking about the topic of prediction in general because, you know, I think looking to the past is as important as looking to the future. And, you know, so let's talk about resilient web design. The reason why it sort of became a history of web design book is because there's lessons we can learn from the past. So whenever we're asking this question, what comes next? What's in the future? It really pays attention to look at past narratives that have happened with different technologies, with, you know, different people in different times. I don't know. Prediction is kind of a mug's game. I'm not sure. If you get it wrong, you're an idiot. And if you get it right, it's like you just got lucky. So I'm not even going to try. I will say that the important thing is I do firmly believe that the future is something that we make. It's not something that just happens to us. Even small effects that we do can influence the future. I think the worst situation is when we assume that there's nothing we can do. These things will happen no matter what. And we just have to either get on board with it or get out of the way. Again, I'm talking very vague generalities, and this is kind of a philosophical viewpoint. But I think that's more important than asking, you know, what comes next? It's more like, well, what are we going to do next? What are we going to make next? What are we going to maybe nudge? Maybe you can't rip everything out and start from scratch, everything you disagree with, everything you think should be better. You can't, you know, have a clean slate. But, okay, what are you going to do today that could nudge things for the future? You know, maybe there's a small thing you could do today that could have a small effect today that grows into a bigger effect if other people do it, if more people, you know, agree to do things the same way. So I don't know, it's less about trying to predict what the future will be and deciding, you know, well, what's the future you want to and how can we work towards building that together?
So good. Before my last question, I do have a listener question.
Oh, great.
It's from it's from a Brad Frost.
Oh, okay. Okay.
He'd like to know, what's your favorite Daft Punk album?
Very funny, Brad. Very funny. Well, Jason, if you've listened to Salt of Cain, you will know that our musical styles are somewhat different. Let me put it that way. So I refuse to answer the question.
Okay. You're plead the fifth?
Pleading the fifth there.
Oh, very good. Very fine and well. My last question, Jeremy, and it's a little deep. It's kind of deep. If today was your last day on Earth, what would your final words be to the current and future builders of the web?
Ooh, that's an interesting one. Well, this is an interesting philosophical one because, you know, I've been putting words online now for quite a while, over 15 years on my own website, the occasional book, Resilient Web Design now. So one of the nice things about that is that it's cumulative, right? As long as I can take some steps to ensure that those URLs stick around, that my website's still accessible well into the future, what my last words are don't really matter. It's not really important. I mean, it would be nice to have something something pithy to wrap it up with. Maybe it's, that's all, folks. I don't know. But maybe my last words are, do a search through the archives on whatever interests you, because I've been building up, basically, my website is all my last words, right? Like, when I'm no longer here, as hopefully the website could still be there, and all of it accessible. It's something I wrote in 2011, something I wrote in 2002, something I wrote last week.
Yeah.
Still accessible, which again is, gets to the superpower of the web. So I'm sort of dodging the question because I'm saying it's not important. I'm saying the latest entry isn't as important as the cumulative effect of the latest entries. But maybe I should make every update to my website, every little tweet-like note or every link or every blog post, I should write as if they're my last words. But I don't think it would make any difference to the way I write and share and put things out there. So I'm totally dodging the question to say my last words to the community, the people building websites out there would be https://adactio.com.
I'm just sitting in this moment, Jeremy. That was so good, man. I love that.
That's a total cop-out. That's such a cop-out question.
No.
It was not a great question with a cop-out answer.
Not at all. No. I think that your answer couldn't have been deeper, my friend. Your life's work are your final words, and God willing, and I hope they'll be around for all time, for future generations. I mean, it would be really fascinating if somebody's listening to this 100 years from now and adactio.com is still intact. I found my old portfolio from 2000 recently, searching through some old files. I put it on the browser and it still works. And it still looks the same as it did. It's
there
still
you
my,
go.
My,
there
my
you
Dreamweaver go. My Dreamweaver JavaScript hover still work even. And it's built in frames and it still looks identical to how it was. It really kind of, I don't know. There's something there. There's a lesson there, I guess.
There is, because if you found other files from that time, 2000 was it you said the portfolio was
yes.
from?
Your Y2K.
If you found other files from that time period and you tried to open them on a computer today, I think you'd have a hard time.
And that, Defenders, I think is the biggest takeaway from our whole time. Build for the future and let your life's work be your legacy. Let it be your canon. Let it be your magnum opus, just like Jeremy is, and all of the generosity that he shared.
Okay, you're making it sound so much more grandiose than
no,
it is.
No, my friend.
Like, my website is just this place where I dump my brain farts. So let's not build it up into something that it's not. But it does represent me.
Yes.
So there's that.
And I love your humility, Jeremy. And you know, and I think that's one thing that I just love about you is that you're gonna write no matter who's reading it. If nobody's reading it, you're still gonna write. And I think that's what a true writer is. You just have so much to express, and you've done that, and you write for the joy of it. You write for the joy of building the community up and sharing what you know, sharing your life, and again, another beautiful thing about the web. And I just want to close with saying, you know, your talk, you know, it's so fresh in my mind still, but I was able to find it on YouTube recently that you did at an event apart Denver. I'll be honest with you, you are gifted in how you share your knowledge and how you draw from past advances. And I've learned so much from you just about, you know, pioneers of technology. And it was so neat to see, like, most of the folks on your presentation were all women that really shaped, you know, a lot of tech and space program and, you know, Margaret Hamilton and Nicola Pello, you mentioned in Resilient Web Design. I haven't heard of these folks really. And so I think it's so incredible. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, like there wasn't a dry eye in the house, I don't think, at the end of your talk, and just how philosophical and how great. I'm probably giving you a huge head, man. Don't let it go to your head. No.
You're totally inflating my ego.
Oh man, no, but it's just, I'll be honest with you. And I had an interaction with a gal that I kind of got to know during the event, and she's like, is it just me? I said, no, it's not just you.
Wow.
And your last words on the talk were, do you remember, you probably know because you've memorized it. Can you give us those last words on the talk?
Well, I was kind of referencing this sort of meme. It was going back to talking about the future where, you know, just this attitude that it's the future, take it, you know, like the future is something that happens to you.
Yes.
And I was saying more that, you know, let's get out there and make sure that it's the future, make it. And
yes.
Yeah. Just, I'm always very curious, genuinely curious to see what people make.
That's it right there. Jeremy, what's the best way to connect and to keep up with you for our defenders?
https://adactio.com. That is, the canonical representation of me on the web. And from there, you can find links out to other representations of me, you know, on Twitter or Medium or these other places. But anything that you see on those other places would have started life on my own website. And I send the copies out there. So yeah, my own website. And you can get in touch with me through there. You can subscribe to RSS feeds if you want to keep track of me that way, or follow the Twitter account, which, you know, syndicates from my website. Yeah, however people want to do it. But go to my website if you want to know me.
Jeremy, thank you so much for being here today. This has been an incredibly deep and insightful, and I'm a little emotional, to be honest with you, conversation.
Oh.
And I don't know. I don't know how to kind of wrap this up other than just keep doing what you're doing. Your work is making a greater impact than I think you realize, and maybe that you ever will realize, maybe even far past when you're not here anymore. But just keep doing what you're doing, my friend. And I just want to say, fight on, my friend.
Thank you so much.
I don't know what it is about Jeremy, but he has a way of really diving deep and thus making us feel deeply. It's the same way if you ever have the great privilege of hearing him speak live. He's definitely a historian, and his uncanny ability to connect the dots with the past, present, and future is certainly one of his superpowers. The web is such an amazing gift that is neither good nor evil, nor is it neutral. It's an amplifier. Let's use it to amplify the good and serve one another as intended. Tweet your takeaways, Defenders, and mention User Defenders. I'd love to engage with you there, and it really helps get the word out about the show. Oh, please help me fight on by leaving a rating and review on iTunes as well. A simple way to do that is by going to userdefenders.com/review. I may even end up sharing it on a future episode. I want to thank Eli Jorgensen for the astonishing artwork. I absolutely loved his rendering of Jeremy. If reincarnation were true, I know Jeremy would want to come back as an HTML tag, fighting for the users. Thanks, Envision, for sponsoring this episode. In 2 weeks, I'll be joined by another wonderful superhero who was on my Advent Apart panel, Cassie McDaniel. Cassie is also a deep diver, and just to give you a taste for what's to come, listen to this blurb from her bio. Cassie tends to jump right in. She is never satisfied with the status quo or the usual path, and will rarely let not knowing how to do something stop her. Tell me that's not going to be good. Thanks so much for listening and telling others about the show, Defenders. It really means a ton to me, and it helps other designers stay inspired on this sometimes arduous, yet always rewarding journey. And until next time, as always, fight on, my friends.